for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Bill Clinton says the people of America owe a great debt to Andrew Young. The former president praises Young's four decades of sometimes controversial service as an activist, public servant, teacher, and preacher. Now the one-time UN ambassador and Atlanta mayor is playing a new role, mentored to his godson, Kabir Segal. They joined me in the studio to talk about their new book. It's a collection of conversations between elder sage and the eager student. It's titled Walk in My Shoes. They're both here in the studio with me. I look forward to hearing from you. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to both of you and welcome.
Good morning, and it's good to be here.
Thank you. You've come on a day when Dorothy Hite is being memorialized at the Cathedral. Andrew Young, I know you spoke last night.
I did, and I have known and loved Dorothy Hite as long as I can remember. And she was, like most of the women in the Civil Rights Movement, we couldn't have made it without them. They worked too much in the background quite often. They never got their full recognition. In fact, last night when I spoke, I apologized to the women for Dorothy Hite not getting to speak at the March on Washington.
Huh.
And there might not have been a March on Washington because these were a group of six organizations, and these were all very young men who had each had their idea of how social change should go about. And she, I said last night that nobody ever thought of her as a basketball player. But she talked about, you know, her high school basketball team winning the state championship. And I always say that good basketball players learn teamwork and they learn how to make other people play together.
That's what she did.
And she did that.
But did the young men around her not wish to have her speak at the March on Washington?
I am not sure. They were so busy fighting for their own time. Ironically, all of them wanted to speak early because they didn't think the crowd was going to stay very long. And so Martin Luther King got pushed to last. It was a big fuss over who would get to speak and who would not speak. And I think just to preserve her own integrity and objectivity, she pulled herself out of the situation and sort of presided, as she would do, quietly over and making suggestions to resolve every conflict.
Kabir, did you ever have a chance to meet Dorothy Hite?
I did not, unfortunately, but I feel it in kind of a way, as I hear Mr. Young speaking right now, I kind of met her spirit through him. He just mentioned how Dorothy Hite worked in the background, worked it behind the quarters. I think Andy Young is a good example of that. We know of his accomplishments, but so many times he's told me, Kabir, you can get anything done in your life that you like as long as you give other people credit. And that's one of the resounding mantras I've heard since I've been a little kid. Mr. Young has received credit for a lot of things. There's a lot of things in the Civil Rights Movement that I, in the course of working on this book and these interviews, I discovered that, wow, Mr. Young was actually very much the contrarian, very much the devil's advocate for Dr. King. And he told me a great story about the time you were frustrated with your time with Dr. King, and you're giving him advice, and you started to agree with some of the more radical perspectives other people were giving him. And what was the story?
No, he stopped the meeting and said, excuse me, I need to run to the restroom. He said, Andy, come on with me. And he got me back there, and he said, look, he said, I need you to be as far to the right as you possibly can. you know, half of these guys are emotional and crazy, and said, you have to be on the, if you're not going to move to the right and leave me enough room in the middle to make a rational decision, I don't need you. You just will get out of here if you're going to act like they're acting. So it always put me in a position of giving him room to make a logical political decision that kept all of the factions of the movement together. And I just had to learn to be comfortable in my role.
How old were you at that time?
I was about 32, 33.
Mm-hmm. And Dr.
And he was
King,
about, he was a little over 3 years older than
I
me.
I see. Mm-hmm. Tell me how the two of you, Kabir and Andy Young, came together.
Well, he walked into my office shortly after I was elected mayor and asked for an interview for his second-grade newspaper.
He was kind to do that because we had this crazy idea of doing a second-grade newspaper, and our principal didn't want to do that. And my father and Mr. Young worked together, and I asked Mr. Young if he would oblige, and then I went to the principal and I said, we have a first interview with Ambassador Andrew Young, and they said, well, it looks like we're going to have our newspaper after all. So he walked in, and we did a first interview. I don't really remember what it was about, but it's kind of kept on going, and we've had thousands of conversations throughout the years.
So you would have been 7 years older thereabouts.
Yeah, you know, there's just about exactly 50 years difference between us. And it really started before that, because when I went to the United Nations, the Indian ambassador was a good friend of his father's. And the Indian ambassador was one of the elder statesmen at the UN. And he had actually known Gandhi, I think. And he knew that I was a Gandhian disciple. And Kabir's father got us together for lunch. And from that point on, Ambassador Jaipal always called me off on the side and gave me wise advice. And the kind of advice that he would give me would be the sort of thing that I couldn't get from the State Department, that I couldn't even get from our intelligence services, because he had been there, he knew everybody, he knew the words that would trigger dissent, and he knew how to win people over. And he really was a behind-the-scenes mentor to me. And he was probably, well, I was about 45 when I went to the UN, and he was probably pretty close to 80 at that time.
So, in effect, what you are doing is both paying back and paying forward.
It is, and there's another thing in the middle there, that at Robert Kennedy's funeral, when I went to pay my respects to Ethel Kennedy and the family, she said, you know, I was here in Resurrection City with all of the mud on my overalls and boots and everything. And they said, you know, one thing that Robert Kennedy did that they'd never seen another public official do, and that is take time out to talk to students. Mm. They said he never missed an opportunity to visit a school. And she turned to me and she said, young man, if you ever get to be somebody, I hope you'll never turn down an opportunity to visit a school. And I promised there, and I sort of thought of that as one of the ways that I could commit, as I had committed to carrying on Martin Luther King's legacy, that was one of the things that I could do that would continue the Robert Kennedy legacy as well.
Andrew Young, he served as mayor of Atlanta, U.S. congressman from Georgia, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He's also a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Kabir Sehgal is Andrew Young's godson. He works for J.P. Morgan. He served as a special assistant to former Senator Max Cleland and on Senator John Kerry's presidential campaign. He's the author of Jazzocracy, Democracy and the Creation of a New American Mythology. Do join us, 800-433-8850, as we talk about this book, that both Andrew and Kabir have written together, titled Walk in My Shoes, Conversations Between a Civil Rights Legend and His Godson on the Journey Ahead. And Andrew Young has just passed me a hardcover copy of the book with a photograph on the cover of a very young Kabir. Kabir, what did you want to accomplish with this book?
Well, you ever read like a great American classic and like a Ralph Waldo Emerson or a Mark Twain novel? And I mean, I read some of those books when I was in high school. And then when I was in my last days of college, I was rereading some of those again. And I said, wow, there's a lot of great material in this stuff if you read it for a second time. And I was having hundreds of conversations with Mr. Young throughout college.
And you still call him Mr. Young?
Mr. Young, Uncle Andy.
Okay.
You know, there's...
Whatever.
Right, right. He's very accessible like that. And I just thought, you know, it would be wise of me to get some of the material that he's given me down on paper. And why that came about was on my college graduation day. He came and he received an honorary degree while in college. And he said, Kabir, I want to give you something. And he reached in his pocket and he put something in my hand. And I forgot about it. And then about a week later, I was, my mom and we were in Atlanta at home and we were doing the laundry. And she said, you have something in your pocket. And I forgot. I was like, shoot, that's the letter Mr. Young gave to me. And I went to go get it. And he wrote this letter to me and he said, Kabir, I want to give you some advice. You can do anything you want in the world as long as you give other people credit. And that was a great kind of moment, an opening salvo of how this book could begin.
Short break, right back. Welcome back. Andrew Young is with me, former mayor of Atlanta, U.S. congressman from Georgia, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Kabir Segal is Andrew Young's godson. Together, they have written this book titled Walk in My Shoes, Conversations Between a Civil Rights Legend and His Godson on the Journey Ahead. You know, Ambassador Young, it does seem to me that so many young people today, especially in the face of the kind of economic turmoil this country is facing, and especially African Americans, are facing great difficulties. Your godson is employed. Many are not. What do you say to those who are not, who feel betrayed by this system?
Well, fortunately, I'm in Atlanta. And as mayor and as chairman of the co-chairman of the Olympic Committee, in my 8 years, we created over 1 million jobs in Atlanta. And so I don't get much blame because people feel as though I kind of did my part. We have a thriving city. We don't have the unemployment level that we'd like. But we also have something called a Hope Scholarship, which we tied the lottery to education. So all of the lottery funds go to preschool and higher education. So anybody that gets a B average and 1100 on the SAT can go to Georgia colleges free. And those are things that are part of my local legacy. And what I've tried to do is, for instance, our previous mayor was my administrative assistant. And she formed her own scholarship fund. She raised almost $25 million. And every student that needed money to get to school. We also have Atlanta Technical College, where 98% of the students who enroll there end up coming out with a job. So there are jobs in Atlanta. And we are constantly trying to grow the economy. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not unemployment and we have homelessness. But that's one of the reasons why I got hooked up with Kabir, because I think these are macroeconomic problems. I was listening to your program and about the Greek economy by itself can't make all the adjustments that are needed. No city can make adjustments. And I was on the banking committee when I was in Congress, and we made a decision back in 1973. We had a stable global economy under the Bretton Woods agreements. And then all of a sudden, we stopped. And we went on to the economics of Milton Friedman. And nobody ever stopped to think about that, because Watergate broke shortly after that Bretton Woods decision. And then when I was in the Carter administration after that, the economists there could never seem to get a handle on the economy, because we never went back to analyze the assumptions under which we were operating. When we looked at when I looked at what happened when Newt Gingrich took over the Congress, they repealed Regulation Q. Now, I was on the banking committee because we were building a mass transit system. I wasn't a banker, didn't know anything about economics, never had a course in economics. But I knew that Regulation Q separated savings and loans from commercial banks. When they broke that down, the savings and loans started getting into things that they didn't know anything about, and they all went bankrupt. And that left us without an experienced housing market. And then the commercial banks went into the housing market, and they didn't know anything about that, and they started packaging mortgages and calling them derivatives, and I didn't know what that was. He's working for a big bank, and so it's as much me asking him, what are these derivatives, and why are they causing so much trouble?
I'm glad.
What's a hedge fund?
Exactly. We've all been learning about those
and so
things.
It's a mutual debate.
Now, Kabir, one of the questions you asked of Andrew Young was, how did you find your path? So many of us are directionless and rudderless. Do you still feel that way?
I think I do, certainly. And you mentioned that I'm employed and I have a job. And I want to just mention something. I couldn't get through one conversation in this book with Mr. Young without him mentioning the word jobs, macroeconomics. So much about the civil rights movement was about jobs and this macroeconomic perspective. We talked earlier about the March on Washington. Dr. King, as Mr. Young, Andy told me, Dr. King said the Negro was given a check and it took that check to the Bank of Justice and it was marked insufficient funds. And the march was called the March for Freedom and Jobs. Now, the jobs part is interesting because that's arguably the part of the civil rights movement that was not enacted fully, right? Because there was the Poor People's Campaign, and that kind of spun out and didn't fully get enacted. And I think Mr. Young was talking to me. He said, Kabir, if you want to learn something about helping the poor people, if you want to help something about helping those who don't have anything, have much, go work at a bank. Go work about money. Go learn about money. You know, 3 years ago, it's kind of an odd contrarian perspective. 3 years ago, a banker won the Nobel Peace Prize, Muhammad Yunus. He's taking the lessons of finance and taking it to third world countries. So if you work at these financial institutions and use those tools for good and for the advancement of others, that's wonderful. And so much of what I'm doing right now is learning about markets, learning about emerging markets, and seeing how capitalism can be a tonic and ameliorate people around the world. And I think for me, you know, I kind of reluctantly got into finance. I was rudderless, and it was kind of the thing to do after college. And for me, it's given me a take on how the world works, how allocation
of money. It was something I encouraged. And my daughter and I, to this day, she's a Georgetown Law School graduate. And I tried to get her 30 years ago, 20 years ago anyway, to go into an investment banking firm. I said, if you want to help poor people, you've got to understand how an economy works. So you can't help poor people one at a time. I believe in what I call public purpose capitalism. In Atlanta, we define the public purpose, say an airport. And we all agreed that we needed a new airport. And then we wrote it up and got the private sector to buy into it, and we sold municipal bonds. And the city was the guarantor of last resort. And we built an airport that's probably worth $10 billion and didn't cost the taxpayer a penny.
But the problem is, now, as you well know, Ambassador Young, that public purpose capitalism has become the face of Goldman Sachs' egocentric capitalism. This is not necessarily working for the good of people who are in need, but rather people who already have it.
Well, let me, again, seem to be on the wrong side of this, because, you know, I don't blame Goldman Sachs. I mean, they are greedy, but I identify with them. See, it's sort of like this economy is so free, is so creative. The analogy I use, if you give me a Ferrari and put me out on the beltway with no speed limit, see, it's just a matter of time before I kill myself or kill somebody else.
But you talked about the abolishment of Regulation Q.
Exactly, which I was against. See, I think you need, I put it this way, I don't like regulations, but you need speed limits. We've got a wonderful bunch of young people, but they all got cars, and they got iPhones and computers. You cannot text and drive and live. See, and the freedom that this economy has offered is so, the global economy gives us such a forum of freedom that there's nobody wise enough to negotiate it without us sitting down together. And I would call it democratic capitalism or humanitarian capitalism. And I've had some very good experiences with Goldman Sachs. We selected Goldman Sachs when I was on the Cox Communication Board because Cox wanted to take a public company and take it private. And when we looked around at the investment banking firms, the people that seemed most trustworthy happened to be Goldman Sachs.
Do you still feel that way, considering what's happened in Greece, considering what's happened in the United States?
Sure, I feel that way because we picked. I mean, it's like saying
but
that.
But the market's changed a lot since
picked. The market has changed, but I think that the people, well, let me just say, we picked Goldman Sachs Midwestern office because the Midwestern office was sort of close to Warren Buffett, and there was still a practical all-American value system there, and the young man, Byron Trott, I shouldn't give him that kind of credit, but he seemed to come to us with a kind of fairness and integrity that would be fair to both the shareholders and the Cox family that was trying to buy this back. And it was a very difficult negotiation, but it was free and fair. And it worked for everybody. Now, that's not true. And the day I was put on that committee, I think I got sued by 40 people. So that everything we did was under the scrutiny of the world. And the problem with the people that are there now is there's no supervision. Mm-hmm. There's no transparency, see? And it bothers me, I shouldn't say this, but that we always talk about corruption in Africa or in big cities. But the corruption in Africa is like, you know, I mean, it's chump change.
Compared to
what we see happening, and again, I'm not judging, I'm questioning. I don't think you ought to be able to put a bunch of paper together and put a fancy name on it and sell it and make a profit if the paper doesn't create any jobs, doesn't feed any hungry, doesn't clothe, doesn't heal. These paper transactions, it seems to me. But if somebody is investing, I mean, I caught a lot of flack in Atlanta about bringing in foreign investors. The Dutch came in and put $1.5 billion in Atlanta the first term I was mayor. And people said, what are you doing? You're selling out to the Dutch. I said, well, they can't take it. You know, they built two Ritz-Carlton hotels. They built a perimeter mall. They built Phipps Plaza. They built a building that they later sold to the Japanese that was the IBM building. And they created jobs.
Former Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Kabir, why do you think that poverty was not the focus of the civil rights movement, considering what you've learned?
Well, that's a good question. I think it ended up being that way. I think there was, you know, a racial issue of getting civil rights, and there was voting rights. And Mr. Young told me once, he said that he wanted to go see Ralph Bunche at the United Nations. And he said to Dr. King and Andy, he went to go see him, he said, listen, you guys are trying to do too much. You're trying to be anti-Vietnam, trying to get civil rights enacted, and you're trying to cure poverty. That's too much, and you guys are being too public about it. I actually think, in looking back at the movement, that maybe you guys just ran out of time. Hmm. And also, Mr. Young always says to me that when you peel back the scab of poverty, or excuse me, the scab of racism, you get the cancer of poverty. And racism is, you know, it's just kind of war on poverty.
How involved are you in the problems of poverty in your own work?
Well, I work with an organization called Music for Tomorrow. And it's after Katrina, what happened, a few of our friends, my friend Brent and actually the actor Jude Law, we started an organization to bring musicians back to New Orleans. Because I'm a jazz musician. I've played professionally for years. And what happened, we brought some musicians back. And then I had this conversation with Mr. Young about the macroeconomic solution. So we said, wait a second, how can we figure out a market-based solution to get musicians back? So what we do is you can basically go on our website. If you need a musician for a wedding, a funeral, a bar mitzvah, you simply go to our website, Music for Tomorrow, and book a jazz musician, and we donate 100% of our commissions back to charities in New Orleans. So we're rebuilding New Orleans one gig at a time. Right, so that macroeconomic solution comes directly from the conversations that I had from Mr. Young. I could raise $1 million and then run out of that money at the end of the year. But this way, we provide a very sustainable method. New Orleans gave the world jazz, and now we're giving back to New Orleans one gig at a time. So that's an example of how I've been inspired by the civil rights movement. And so many of us, I think, have so much to learn from the civil rights movement, because people my age in their mid-20s, late-20s, we learned about American history. And in the last few weeks of American history class, we were kind of skimming through the civil rights movement. We learned about the Civil War. We learned about the American rights and the Revolutionary War. but America's second civil war, really, or the second Revolutionary War, was a civil rights movement. And so many are still alive and we can learn from them. And that was one of the purposes of this book, was to teach my generation and help instruct my generation on figuring out things like, for instance, Dr. King's take on the Jericho Road. He said, "I do not want to be a good Samaritan. I envy the good Samaritan. But instead of picking up people who are bleeding on the side of the road, I want to put a traffic light there, and I want to put a police officer there and make sure the person isn't beat up in the first place." So that was very inspirational for me, and I take that inspiration and apply it to new methods. One of the great inventors of all time, Tom Edison, he said something like, "Genius is not the idea itself. Genius is the adaption of an idea to a new purpose." So our movement is not going to look like a carbon copy of the civil rights movement, but we're going to take tenets and principles and be inspired by people like Uncle Andy and use it to forge our own movement. And that's the great work of our generation. And I'm very happy that that's what we've kind of talked about in this book, and that's the challenge ahead.
Kabir Segal and Andrew Young, together, they have written a new book titled Walk in My Shoes.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help families earn it, keep it, save it during Financial Literacy Month, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
Promises, promises, that's Sean Hayes in the new Broadway revival of Promises, Promises. You probably know him best as Jack from the TV series Will and Grace. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sean Hayes, and former poet laureate Robert Haas returns to talk about Walt Whitman. Haas edited a new collection of Whitman poems. Join us. I'm laughing out loud.
Andrew Young and his godson, Kabir Segal, are with me. Their new book is titled Walk in My Shoes, Conversations Between a Civil Rights Legend and His Godson on the Journey Ahead. We have an email here from Jill, who'd like to know what your reasons were for not supporting President Obama during the election.
Well, I supported him during the general election, but I had known Hillary Clinton since she was in college. My mother's godchild, Grant Hill's mother, and Hillary graduated together, and we knew about her challenge of Senator Ed Brooke in her commencement speech. My wife had worked with her on the Children's Defense Fund with Marion Edelman. I met Bill Clinton through Hillary Clinton, and this was way back. And so the only reason I would vote for him seemed to me would be color. And that was not enough. And I said, though, that I would support him, continue to support him for president, but in 2016, because I really felt very close to Hillary Clinton.
How do you feel about the president now?
Well, let me just say that halfway through there, I realized, one, he was running a better campaign than she was. The other thing was that his demeanor. I really believe that nonviolence works. And I think that his calm, his quintessential cool is what the nation needs. And I think his refusal to fight is the way to win over your opposition. And even with, the thing that we did in the civil rights movement was win over our opponents. And we didn't do it by arguing with them or criticizing them. We did it by trying to understand their point of view and giving them every opportunity to express it and never defending ourselves. But usually in spouting off against us, they saw themselves that this didn't work. And it made it easier for us to reconcile. And after all, I did that for a living, and I saw him as very much in that tradition. See?
You also called it a survival skill to be cool under pressure as a young African-American male. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. I grew up 50 yards from the German-American Bund, and I could hear people heiling Hitler before when I was in kindergarten. And my parents had to explain to me white supremacy and racism, and my father's mantra was, you don't get mad with sick people. You help them. Hmm. And you never lose your temper and get angry in a fight. Don't get mad, get smart.
And on that note, Jill also asks, would you care to share your views on the present rift between the two factions of the SCLC?
I would, but I decided a long time ago that the SCLC was a movement, and we finished in 1970. And we should have closed it down.
Huh.
And now it's trying to survive as an organization. I don't think we need another organization. I encouraged Bernice King and Martin King and all of the other young people, start your own movement, but don't try to revive an organization that's dominated by a whole lot of old, tired, mostly crazy people.
All right, let's take a call from San Diego, California. Good morning, Edward. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. It's an honor to speak with Ambassador Young. I was wondering about his experience, and maybe he could give us his perspective on the factionalization in the 60s of the civil rights movement related directly to the SCLC and SNCC. And what his experience was as a Gandhian disciple, working with these young folks in SNCC who were very, you know, very emotional, but trying to move take the movement forward in their own way. And I'll take my question off the air.
Thank you so much.
Well, actually, we did that, and we did it constantly. It was like working with our younger brothers. We supported them financially. We raised money together. We worked together. But there were questions of trust. For instance, in the march from Selma to Montgomery, we wanted to wait and respect the decision of Judge Frank Johnson because we knew Frank Johnson. He was a Republican, and we didn't know what he was going to decide, but we knew he'd be fair. They hadn't focused on the judiciary. We were also being advised by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund that was in communication with John Doerr and Ramsey Clark. And they weren't aware of that. So they called us Uncle Toms and all kinds of names. Yeah. And we agreed with them. Okay, yeah, that's fine. But they couldn't get along without us, and we couldn't get along without them. And for the most part, those who worked closest with us, John Lewis is now congressman from Georgia. Bernard Lafayette has a doctorate and has continued nonviolent work all over the world. Diane Nash is in Chicago. None of them are famous, but all of them are still very active. Cleve Sellers is president of a university in South Carolina, and they're still in a movement.
Now, Kabir, hearing all this directly from Ambassador Young, where does that leave you as to your road ahead? How does what he has recalled for you, how does that help you?
It's tough when you see where Mr. Young has come and where he's gone in his life. Is very intimidating sometimes to speak with Andy and what he's accomplished. And I asked him, I said, what did young people have to do with the movement? And he looked at me and he said, Kabir, young people were the movement.
Were the movement,
right.
Indeed.
And he mentioned this girl, Claudette Colvin, who is a teenager, and she was actually the first person to sit down on the back of the bus before Rosa Parks.
In front of the bus.
In front of the bus before Rosa Parks, and she was arrested. And I think there was so much uproar in the community saying that she was too young and too unknown, and she had recently, I think, was impregnated with a married man and in a relationship with a married man. So she was there. She was young. She was kind of impatient and in a hurry because she had just exited Black History Month and was learning about Harriet Tubman, and she decided to act. And that was inspirational for me, saying that, you know, young people can do something and accomplish great things. And that's what inspired me to move out to Silicon Valley in 2007 and try to start a company or try to do something. Because you see all these guys my age, like, starting Google or YouTube or, you know, we can change the world mentality. Unfortunately, I failed and ran out of money on my startup. But it was okay because I learned that, you know, young people can do things of consequence. And there's an interesting tension that Andy always talks about. He says, you know, it's okay to be young and in a hurry, but also, you know, take your time because life is long. And my dad always says to me, you know, if you want something, go out and get it. And Andy always says sometimes the opposite. He says, we're a leaf in a divine wind. You know that great poem, Invictus, I'm the captain of my soul.
Indeed.
Andy doesn't believe that. So he has some choice words about that in the book. So I said, explain that to me. And he said, you know, everything I've ever wanted is kind of come to me. I've been the reluctant mayor. I ran to be mayor of Atlanta because people came to me and asked me to be a mayor. Same thing with the congressman. And by thinking of himself as a good number two, he's become a very good number one.
Now, here's an email from Art, and this relates to our earlier conversation regarding Goldman Sachs. Art says, I respectfully disagree with Ambassador Young. He says, I hold Goldman Sachs accountable. They knowingly lied to some of their clients. This is political nonsense for the Honorable Andrew Young to not hold them accountable.
Well, it's like holding the Congress accountable. Goldman Sachs is a large institution, maybe 20, 30,000 people, I don't know. The people who lied to their investors ought to be punished. But what I'm thinking is, and what I'm trying to get people to see is, you don't paint the whole financial industry with a red brush. That they did some bad things. Congress made some bad decisions and created a free environment. They took the speed limits down. They did away with the Glass-Steagall Act. They said, go have fun, you know, rape the world. And they did.
And they did.
Now, in the process, Dr. King used to always say, when people are placed in darkness, crimes will be committed. The guilty are not just those who commit the crimes, but those who create the darkness. Now, I would say that the Congress has to take some responsibility for the total deregulation of a global economy. Now, even as I say that, the global economy has done fairly well with India.
Up until now, well, India
and China.
The two.
And when I was growing up, they'd tell me, eat everything on your plate. Think of all the starving people in China. Well, China's got an economy going that's a potential threat to us, but not really much. I see the world more in a development partnership, and I see Africa as the place where we might all get together and where there's enough need and demand and resources to grow an economy that all the rest of us might be able to share in.
Would you like to see Kabir go to Africa and to work there?
No, I would like to see him take his financial friends there and invest there. See, I don't believe in charity. I mean, I really don't. I believe in finding ways to make economies work, because if it's not sustainable, when he grows old, when he dies, or when he gets sick, or if he gets disillusioned, it's over with. Whereas if you create an institutional economic development, and Muhammad Yunus is something of my hero in this. He's grown the Grameen Bank to a $20, $30 billion bank, starting with illiterate women.
These tiny microloans.
Exactly. But now, those don't work everywhere. It's not an automatic formula.
Right.
It requires a certain sense of community. But free enterprise does work and will work for the poor, is my contention.
Former UN Ambassador Andrew Young with his godson, Kabir Sehgal. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Oklahoma City and to Kyle. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. My question is kind of a comment. It seems like most people are confusing the rich getting richer with the economy getting better. Where's the breaking point for the poor in this country? When will they take back what the 1% has had all this time?
Well, I'd be ready for them to take it back right now. I don't think it's good for the economy for there to be wide gaps between rich and poor. In fact, I would say that the rich right now are paying taxes that they don't realize. They're paying it in terms of crime. If you look at any business and ask what they pay for security, it would be much cheaper to put that into public education and create jobs and have those young people paying taxes. My wife got a master's degree for $100 a year. You can't do that now. That's bad politics to make education so expensive.
What do you think of the kinds of financial reform being debated on the Hill as we speak?
Well, I think that that's only scratching the surface. I think we've got to look. I think it started back with Proposition 13 in California, when they said we don't need to pay for public, we don't need good education,
right.
We don't need good health care. We didn't have homelessness until they closed the Veterans Hospital. I think it's a sin and a shame, see, to have our veterans come back from war and not have jobs, not have a GI Bill, not have assistance in finding housing or job retraining. But that's the decisions we made in the 80s that I think destroyed democratic capitalism with a small d.
Do you agree with him, Kabir?
I do. And it's been a kind of a... He's shaped a lot of my thoughts on this thing, and he's really been a ventriloquist as I've learned about finance, and I'm learning about it at work, and then his challenge, the things I learn at work are challenged by Uncle Andy. And he says, I like to challenge you, Kabir, and have uncomfortable opinions and form uncomfortable viewpoints on the world, because that'll make you grow and that'll make you stretch. And sometimes I'm in a conflict, working in finance, but also hearing these things from Andy saying you have to use these things that you're learning for good and make capitalism work for people who perhaps can't have access to it.
Do you find yourself sometimes outside of the inner circle of your financial group?
Well, not all the times, because I feel, very much I look at emerging markets, right? So that means that I'm bringing investment dollars into countries that need it the most. I was in Nigeria recently and saw that you can't ignore Nigeria. There's, you know, 200 million, roughly 200 million people, and it's 20% of the African continent. It's a huge oil, a lot of oil comes to America, trading partner. And we need to come up with a sensible, very sensible policy on how to deal with Africa, how to develop these places, any things we do through tourism. That, you know, one of the most, actually the most profitable flight for Delta Airlines is Atlanta to Lagos, Nigeria. I didn't know that. And I'm learning how we can make markets. If you want to go to Africa, people don't wear shoes. How about creating a place where you can sell shoes to them?
Kabir Segal with his godfather, Andrew Young. They've written a new book titled Walk in My Shoes, Conversations Between a Civil Rights Legend and His Godson on the Journey Ahead. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been
and
fun.
And thanks for joining us today. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones.